Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Mem Ted and Aleph with the first line. The Gemara asks a question. Let us say that when she returns to her father's house, she goes back to her original status. The connection between this question and the previous Gemara is a machloket rishonim. Rashi claims the question is completely independent of the previous Gemara, and it really is referencing back to the Mishnah. And the Gemara is asking, Bayav Alma, as Rashi says, a general question. Ve'ena kushya kol kach. And it's not even such a strong question. But the basic gist of the question is, when the Mishnah says, Harihi b'rshut ha'bal, that once the shluchei ha'av, or the av passes her off to either the baal or the shluchei ha'bal, what happens if something happens in the interim that they never completed the marriage and she returns to her father's house? When we say that if she's gone over to the Rishut HaBaal, is that a permanent status, an irretrievable status? Or is that only temporary, assuming that she doesn't come back to the Rishut HaAv? Can it be reversed? That's the way Rashi reads the question, or views the question, independent of what we had finished off with yesterday. On the other hand, Tosafot, you can actually see there are a couple extra words in Tosafot, in the Divrei HaMatchil, where Rashi begins his Divrei HaMatchil Hachi Garsinan. Rashi clearly took some words out of the Gemara. Tosafot says, Ve'ema Hane Mile, that these words, Hane Mile, referencing back to what we just spoke about, which was the Braita that we lost brought yesterday, which is Tana Masara Av the Shluchei Abal B'Zinta, that once the Av gives it over to the Shluchei Abal, and then she has Nut, the Din is with Chenek, and there the Braita discussed, the Gemara discussed the source for the fact that there's a change in the punishment from Skila to Chenek, and that happens at that transition point. And now the Gemara wants to know, can that be reversed? If she went from the Av, Skila, over to the Baal, and then that changed into Chenek, can that be reversed? For instance, for whatever reason, the marriage falls apart before it gets off the ground, and then she gets engaged to someone else. She is a Nara, Hamurasa, Bitula. She should be Chayavet Skila again. So that's the question of the Gemara. Is there a reversible nature to this status change of the woman? Hey, Amar Rava, how far Pasco, Tana Debei Rabbi Shmuel. This is already addressed by the Beit Midrash, the Tana Debei Rabbi Shmuel. The Tana Debei Rabbi Shmuel. V'neder almanau grusha, kol asher asral nafsha, yakum aleha. The neder of a widow, of a divorcee, anything that she says will take hold. Mata amudomar. Why do I need that pasuk? Halo mutzeit michlal av, umutzeit michlal baal. Why do I need a pasuk to tell me that this woman's on her own reconnaissance if she obviously is on her own? Because she left the auspices of her father to enter into the auspices of her husband. And now her husband doesn't exist anymore. So then who else would we think has influence over the woman? Elo hare shemasar av l'shulchei baal. In a case where the Av gave her over to the Shulchei Abal, O Shemasru Shulchei Av, the Shulchei Abal, or the Shulchim of the Av gave it over to the Shulchei Abal, V'nit Armela B'derech, O Nit Garsha, she was widowed or divorced on the way. So there was no finishing, completion of this marriage. Hechi Ani Koreba, what do I call her now? Beit Aviha Shelzu, O Beit Balo Shelzu. Is she still part of her father's house? Or is she part of the husband's house? Elo lomar lecha, kevin sheyatza shachat mishut av, shuv eino yochol afer. For the moment that she leaves the auspices of her father, there is no returning over there. You can no longer be mefer, you can no longer be annulling the nidarim of this woman. And that's what the pasuk teaches you. Right, so from the point of erusin, there's a joint position between the father and the baal that they both jointly are made for the nidarim. But at the point of transition, which we learned in yesterday's daf, where the shluchei av give it over the shluchei baal, then it transitions completely to the hands of the baal. And what the Gemara's question, at least according to Tosafot, Rashi is not so different, but the question of the Gemara is, at that point in time, when she goes into the reshut baal, is that an irreversible situation? Does that mean that she now is in Rishut HaBaal, even if she's divorced or widowed in that process before the marriage is completed? And therefore, if she's only in the Rishut HaBaal, and irreversibly in the Rishut HaBaal, if the Baal dies, then she's on her own. On the other hand, if it's a, call it, temporary situation, till either one of two things happen. She's in the Reshut HaBaal until either he has Nisuin and completes the marriage with her, or she's in the Reshut HaBaal until he disappears and she goes back to her father's house. Which of the two is it? The conclusion of Tana Debi Rabbi Shmuel is, she is then on her own. She is freed of the auspices of her father because she was handed over to the Baal, and now the Baal doesn't exist. So therefore, she now becomes an independent entity. And that, again, the Gemara saw as being obvious. And then the Pasuk of Neder Almana, Grusha, Kol Asher Asral Nafshei Yakum Aleha, comes to add for us that additional dimension, which is, it's not just true after Nisuin, that if she becomes an Almana or a Grusha, that she's on her own. But even prior to that point, she is then on her own if the husband dies. And that's what the necessity of the Pasuk is to teach us that, which Rashi says, Lama utzrach lechtov yakum aleha, v'chi me yafir la, halo lo nemeru mefirim el avia bebito, ad shelo niseit, ubala mishi niseit, v'zu shenitar mala mishi niseit, mutzeit mechlal av u'mechlal bal. It is very obvious, the fact that she is freed of anybody's control at this point in time. And so why do I need a pasuk to tell me that information? It must be that she was freed of her husband's control before she actually completed the marriage. And therefore, almana ayidei misirat shluchim. And therefore, lefikach ba'katuv hazeh. This pasuk comes to teach you, lemeitcha shlo tikra la beit avia, ela beit isha. We call her not the house of her father, but the house of her husband. V'lo nitrokna mishuta b'mitato shel baal. And the possession or the auspices of her husband do not return or not given over, emptied out back to the father when the husband disappears from this situation. I think what you're asking, the Abnei Nezer actually asks, which is that whenever you have a transaction and you have two parties to a transaction, say a sale, just because the seller has relinquished control doesn't mean it's really left his possession until the buyer actually takes possession. So you have the same thing here, which is if the father already has erusin, so he granted a certain amount of rights to the husband, but the husband has not completed that process until nisuin, which is until he really takes her into the house, has chupa, nisuin, completes everything that we talked about. So there is this interim stage between the time of the shluchei av giving her to the shluchei baal, where the father, in a sense, has relinquished control, but the husband has yet to take control. So whose possession is she in there? The Abnei Nezer says, well, if she's yet to get to the husband's control, that means that she really still is under the auspices of the father. So he answers that the truth is that once a woman is given over to Kiddushin or Erusin, the end game is obvious, which is that she's going to Nisuin. And all the father has to do is step out of the way. And so as soon as the father steps out of the way, that process is in motion to the point where we say that the father's control is completely relinquished. So even though, yes, this is an interim stage, as we discussed yesterday, there are numerous stages for this transition. There's Erusin, which is the first stage. Then there's a passing from the Shluchei Av to the Shluchei Abal, or from the Av to the Shluchei Abal. That's the next transition. The next transition after that is Nisuin, Chupa without Bia. And then Bia is the final stage. So we have all these stages along the way where the woman's slowly becoming totally captured by the husband. And in the interim, we see certain of the items, or certain of the dinim, transition at each point. And so Gemara here is trying to determine what transitions at one point. And we know here at Nidarim clearly transition at this point between the Shluchei Av to the Shluchei Abal. According to Rashi, that's the answer to the question that we're looking at. Tosafot says, from that we will extrapolate to other cases and see that once the father relinquishes control, there's no taking back of that control. And that's what we're learning from this Pasuk or this Tana, Debei Rabbi Shmuel. It's setting us the paradigm at which point that there is no returning to the auspices of the father. Amar Papa, Afanan Nami Tanina. We also have a Mishnah that supports this view of the Braita. Haba al Nara Hamurasa, Inu Chayav Achitei Nara, Bitula Miurasa. Person who has an inappropriate affair with a Nara Murasa, he's only Chayav for Nara Murasa, meaning subject to the punishment that is associated with a Nara Murasa. If she's a Nara, she's a Bitula, and she is a Murasa, Vihi Beveit Aviyah. And she's in her father's house. Bishlama Nara, what is she called a Nara? That's to exclude a Velo Bogeret. Bitula, why is she called a Bitula? Velo Beula. Miurasa, what does that come to exclude? Velo Nisua. Beveit Aviyah, Lemutei Mai. What does he have to be in her father's house? By definition here, seemingly she's in her father's house because she's a Nara Murasa, who's a Bitula. She's not in her husband's house. Lav, Limu'ute Masara Av, Lishluchei Abal. Seemingly it comes to exclude the case where the Av gives her over to the Shluchei Abal. And that is no longer Beit Avia, and she's no longer subject to the rules of Nara Murasa. That is similar to what we saw in the Braita yesterday, that is the transition point from Skila to Chenek, as at the point where the father or the Shluchei Av give her over to the Shluchei Abal. She switches then from being a Nara Murasa to the equivalent of an Eshedish, not for everything, but at least with regards to the punishment in the Torah that we learned out of the Lisnot Beit Avia, that we learned out yesterday. And now we know it also here from the Mishnah itself seems to support what the Braita was saying, is that Beit Avia ends at a certain point, and that's also a transition point. Amar Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, Afanan Namitanina. I'll bring you another Mishnah that supports this understanding, which is a Baal Eshedish, Kemen Shenichnasal Roshuta Baal Nisuin, Afopi Shilo Nivala. Person who has, again, an extramarital affair with a married woman, once she has entered into the possession of the Baal, Lin Nisuin, so Nisuin are completed, even though there is no Biah, Habaaleh Arizeh B'chenek. That is subject to the penalty of Chenek. Nichnasa l'rishut ha'baal be'alma shmamina. Over here, it seems to say that when she enters into the possession of the Baal in general, meaning that it wasn't that literally there's a completion or consummation of the marriage, and that's what causes the transition from the point of Nara Murasar Skila to Chenek, but simply entering into the rishut ha'baal. Once she enters, and that's the statement that was made here, which is our Mishnah, Baal Yeshidish, came in Shenichnasa the Rishuta Baal and Nisuin. As soon as she enters into the Rishuta Baal for Nisuin. And that's what it says, the Gemara says, that's Baalma. I mean, as soon as she enters in, it doesn't mean Chupa, doesn't mean all these final stages, it just simply means, once she reaches the Rishuta Baal and Nisuin, and that's even at that transition point where the Shluchei Av give over to the Shluchei Abal, or the Av gives over to the Shluchei Habal, Shma Mina, this is supportive of what the Braita said yesterday, that at that point, there's a transition from Skila to Chenek at that transition point. Okay, next Mishnah. Ha'av eno chayav b'mizonot bito. A father is not responsible for the sustaining for the food to supply to his daughter. The Gemara also asked a question, and you can even dayek out of this. Why bito? And why is this chayav? The word chayav and bito here are important. The Gemara will discuss that right away after we finish the Mishnah. But here it's clear that the obligation of a father towards a child is that they are not obligated to feed them. Zem midrash darash Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. This drasha was given by Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah lifnei hachachamim b'kerem b'yavna. For before the hachamim in Kerem b'yavna, that was when, after Churban HaBayit, that the Vad HaGadol, or the equivalent of the Sanhedrin HaGdolah, was found in Kerem b'yavna. Kerem b'yavna, Rashi says this, many places in Shas, is because they sat shurot, they sat rows and rows like a vineyard, and that's why it's called Kerem b'yavna. Here, Rashi notes that Darash Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was bo bayom, on that day, the same day that Masechet Ediyot is said many times throughout Shas, whenever you have a Mishnah that says bo bayom, that day was that unique day in which Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was appointed as the Nasi to replace Rabban Gamliel, for the difficulty that he caused Rabbi Yoshua. Numerous instances, the Gemara in Brachot, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, the Gemara in Bechorot. So because of that, he was replaced by Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. And Bo Bayom means on that day where he was appointed the Nasi. And here too, Rashi claims that Rashi Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is also on that day when he was appointed the Nasi. Habanim Yurshu, Babanot Izonu. That the Banim inherit, and the daughters will be sustained. Ma banim inu yorshim el achar mitat av. Just like the sons do not inherit until the father passes away. Afa banot inu nizonot el achar mitat avien. So too, the daughters are only entitled to sustenance from the estate after the passing of their father, implying that before that point in time, there is no obligation. Now, what the drusha is associated with the language of the ketubah. The language of the ketubah juxtaposes the inheritance of the sons to the lazun, the mizonot of the daughters. So the drasha over here is not a drasha from the pasuk, it's actually a drasha from the lishon ha'ktubah. He's being doresh, the language and the order of the ktubah. So it's a different type of drasha that we're used to. Usually when we say darash, it means that he has a pasuk and he's doresh something from the pasuk. Over here he's doresh from the way that the structure of the ktubah is.
When was the Nesach of the Ketubah written?
Right, so very good. It's clear that this is Lashon Hedyot, and that it's put together after the fact. And even more so, the two Takanot have nothing to do with each other. They're probably established independently, and then they were placed together in the Ketubah, just in writing. But that's exactly what Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says. Even though the two Takanot were separate, once they were placed together in the Ketubah, we're going to be Doresh, some significance from that. Now, in terms of Yerusha, we're not talking about Yerusha Midoraita. It's clear that the sons inherit Midoraita, their father, and that has nothing to do with the Ketubah that's written in the Torah. What we're speaking about here is what's called Ketubat Benin Dichrin, which is the Ketubah that belongs to the male children. We spoke about this yesterday also, which is that the Chachamim established that the Ketubah of a woman who predeceases her husband, that Ketubah is inherited by the husband. The dowry and everything that's in the Ketubah is inherited by the husband. The problem is that the husband might have multiple wives. If he has multiple wives and then he passes away, the Yerusha now passes to his children. His children can be children from multiple wives, from many different women, and there's a possibility he has no children from the woman that he inherited. Also, he could have just daughters and not sons from that woman. So for a father giving an idunya, giving a dowry to his daughter, he's going to be reluctant to give a dowry to his daughter, knowing the possibility that this possession or this land or anything he gives to his daughter may end up with people he has absolutely no relationship to. And therefore, all the dowry that was given to this woman who predeceases her husband now will pass to individuals who the father, the grandfather, has no relationship to. So Chazal established within the Ketubah something called Ketubah Binin Dichrin, which is the male children born to a woman will, assuming that there's sufficient monies in the estate, inherit the value of her Ketubah and her dowry, first and foremost. As long as there's after each of the parties, meaning that each woman's children inherit their mother's Ketubah, and everything that's written, if there's something left over to divide Midoraita, then we will exercise this. If there aren't sufficient funds to do that, then obviously Yerusha Midoraita will trump, and we'll say we have to divide it up evenly. But Chazal established this in order to, quote-unquote, encourage the father of this daughter to give more generously, because he has a certain amount of assurance that it will end up with his grandchildren, with his grandsons, rather with the possibility that they end up with other children of this same husband. And that's called Ketubat Binin Dechren. In addition to that, in the Ketubah, there's also another takana, which is that the banot nizonu, that the girls, as long as they are still growing up, and they are not married until the point they go to nisuin, they are entitled to draw sustenance, to draw allowance from the estate in order to sustain themselves, to pay for their clothing and possibly their dowry. They are allowed to take that out of the estate. And that's one of the takanot again. They have no entitlement, mitzad Yerusha Midoraita, they have no entitlement to the estate whatsoever. But the takanat chachamim is that they get precedence in terms of this, and they're granted that right. So what Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, those are juxtaposed in the Ketubah. Those two takanot are juxtaposed. And just like Ketubat Benin Dichrin only applies after the death of the father, they don't inherit their mother's Ketubah until the father dies, so too the banot's right to be izonu, mitoch the estate, is only true after the death of the father. Prior to that time, they have no claim against the estate and no claim against their father. Their father is not obligated to sustain them until that point in time. So now the Gemara asks the question that, again, jumps out from the Mishnah, which is, Bizmizanot bitohu deinu chayav, ha bimzanot bino chayav. The inference that you would draw from our Mishnah is that he's not obligated to give mizanot to his daughter, but he is obligated to give mizanot to his son. Bito nami. Again, with regards to his daughter, chovahu deleka, there's no obligation to sustain or feed his daughters. Ha mitzvahika. But you would imply that maybe there is a mitzvah. It's not obligatory, but there's still a mitzvah associated with that. So those are the two diukim that the Gemara makes out of the Mishnah. And the Gemara asks, Mani Matnitin, who is the author of our Mishnah? Lo Rabbi Meir, Lo Rabbi Yehuda, Velo Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. We have three Tanaim that argue about the father's obligation vis-a-vis his children, and none of them fit what we seemingly have midayik out of our Mishnah, which is Tanya. Mitzvah lazon et abanot, kavachomer libanim. Tanakama, Rabbi Meir, believes that there is a mitzvah to sustain, to give food to the daughters, and the kavachomer certainly to give it to the sons. Daske bitorah, because they are osek in Torah, divrei Rabbi Meir. Even though, as Tosafot points out, the Gemara in Baba Batra and later on in the Masechta says, what we're going to assume here, that only boys that learn Torah inherit their father. The boys that don't learn Torah don't inherit their father. I mean, what type of distinction is this? The Torah says the boys inherit their father. Why should it make a difference if they're learning Torah or not learning Torah? They're entitled to their father's estate. How come here Rabbi Meir doesn't make such a distinction and say, why does it make a difference if the boys are learning Torah or not? So Tosvot says that's different. Because over there, the question of disowning the individual, or disenfranchising the individual from the Yerusha, over there we're going to say that learning Torah is not the be-all and end-all of whether they are entitled to the Yerusha or not entitled to the Yerusha. On the other hand, over here, when we're talking about a Takana Dirabanan, then we're going to say that those that are learning Torah certainly have greater rights than those that are not learning Torah, because it's only a Takanat Chachamim at this point in time. Yehuda Meir, mitzvah lazonet abanim, v'kabachomer lebanot. Rabbi Yehuda sees it just the opposite, that the mitzvah is to sustain the sons, v'kabachomer, and certainly the daughters, mishum ziluta, because it's beneath the dignity of a girl to have to go around and collect, to go door to door to collect, or even if they go door to door, that we might see poor outcomes from that in their behavior or in what they do in order to get mizonot. And therefore, we clearly would say that if he has to sustain the sons, that's a mitzvah, certainly he has to sustain his daughters. Now, in the end, basically, Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda say the same thing, which is, it's a mitzvah to sustain a son and a mitzvah to sustain a daughter. Is there any difference in their opinion? So there are those that say that it has to do with precedence. Who gets precedence? Meaning that in a situation where there isn't sufficient to sustain both of them, then who gets precedence over here? Is it the daughters that get precedence? Or is it the sons that get precedence over here? That might be the nafkamina between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch Omer, chuvah lazun et abanot, lachar mitat abiyen, aval b'chayevim elu ve'elu einin nizonin. Yochanan ben Baruch says it's an obligation to sustain the daughters after the father dies. But during the lifetime of their father, neither the daughters nor the sons have any entitlement whatsoever to being sustained by their father. Mani matnitin. Who's the author of our Mishnah? I Rabbi Meir. If it's Rabbi Meir, Hamar Banim Mitzvah. He says, Banim are Mitzvah. We were Medayek at our Mishnah that the daughter is not a Chovah, but a son is a Chovah. So he doesn't fit in. I Rabbi Yehuda Amar Banim Nami Mitzvah. He also says that Banim are a Mitzvah. So again, he can't fit into our deal of our Mishnah, which is Benot are not Chiyuv, but Banim are. I Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch, Afilo Mitzvah Nami Leka. According to Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch, there's no mitzvah whatsoever to any of the parties here, which again goes against both the yukim we made out of the Mishnah, one that Banayim are chayav and Banot is a mitzvah. So Gemara says, Ibaiteima Rabbi Meir, Ibaiteima Rabbi Yehuda, Ibaiteima Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch. Some say the authorship is Rabbi Meir, the attribution is Rabbi Yehuda, or the attribution is Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch, and we'll explain how. Ibaiteima Rabbi Meir, some say that it's Rabbi Meir, Vachi Kamar. Hayav enu chayav b'mizanot bito. Father's not obligated in the mizonot mizvah, who I didn't even know. And so is true by his son. Ha, mitzvah bebito, ika. From the Mishnah, you would infer that there is a mitzvah with regards to his daughter. Kal v'chomer libanim. Certainly the banim, because Rabbi Meir thinks that the banim have more entitlement, so there's more reason to give to them. V'haydik tani bito. So then why does it mention a bat in the Mishnah? Hakamash malon, that teaches us that afilu bito, chovahu deleka, ha mitzvah ika. Because you would have thought the possibility is that there's nothing vis-a-vis the daughter. Not a chovah, not a mitzvah. So it specifically mentions bat, because there you would have a havamina that there's no mitzvah. So it tells you that by the bat, no chiyuv, but yes mitzvah. Kal v'chomer to a ben that there is no chovah, but there is a mitzvah. V'ibayitzeim Rabbi Yehuda. Some say the attribution of the authorship of our Mishnah is Rabbi Yehuda. V'achi kamar. And this is what's meant over here. Ha'avenu chayav b'mizanot bito. A father is not obligated in the mizanot of his daughter, but gol shekein libino. Certainly his son. Ha mitzvah bibino. From here it seems that there is a mitzvah by his son. Iko. V'kal v'chomer lebanot. And certainly for the benot. V'adukhtani bito. So then why did it write bat? Ha'kamash wanda afilu bito chovah leka. To teach you that even by the daughters there's still no obligation. You would have a mina because of ziluta that the father might be obligated in the sustaining of his daughters. The answer is, kamash malon, chovah leka. There's not even a chovah by the daughters. And again, the children will then be equal in the sense that there is a mitzvah. V'ibaiteima Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch. Some say that Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch is the author of our Mishnah. V'achi kamar. Enu chayav b'mizanot bito, v'adin livno. He's not chayav in sustaining his daughter, and the same is true of his son. V'adin dafilu mitzvah nami leka. There's not even a mitzvah. Forget about a chovah obligation. There's not even a mitzvah. V'adin d'banot achar mitat avien chovah. So what would have been the havamina? Since after the death of the father, there's an obligation to sustain the daughters out of the estate, Tananami enu chayav. Therefore, it says beforehand, it comes to say, yes, the obligation starts after the death of the father, but no such obligation starts before that point in time. So the Lashon reflects what is true after the death of the father. It just says that's not true prior to the death of the father. So it uses a language which is suitable for after the death of the father, and it just says before that point in time, there is no obligation. So therefore, any one of these three could be the authors of our Mishnah, obviously with nafkaminu as to what the father's obligation is vis-a-vis the children. So now we have a very important statement over here. Amar Rabbi Yala, Amar Reish Lakish Mishum, Rabbi Yehuda Bar Chanina, or some say Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, Bu'usha Hitkinu. Usha is one of the places that the Sanhedrin was Nidgaleh, and in that instance, they made many takanot, which we're going to see a lot of them, a number of them here, over the next couple of dapim. But in Usha Hitkinu She'adam Zanit Panav Vet Bunutav She'en Ketanim. There they were mitakein, that a person has to sustain or should sustain his children, boys and girls, while they are youngsters. So here, even though, again, Mina Torah, there is no obligation on a parent to sustain the children, nevertheless, Be'usha, they established that there will be such an obligation, or there will be a demand on the parents to sustain their children. Correct. Okay, they're very good. So that's what I was just about to speak about, which is, what does it mean here, Ketanim? Rashi reads Ketanim vis-a-vis Gdolim, which is that the obligation here is for Ketanim, those are minors, and therefore minors, there is an obligation to sustain them. Gedolim, as soon as they reach Shtei Se'arot, reach the age of puberty, there is no longer an obligation on a parent to sustain their children at that point in time. And the Usha, the Takana of Usha was for Ketanim vis-a-vis Gedolim. Until now, there was no obligation whatsoever for a child or sustaining a child. Rashi says this introduced that obligation. That obligation is for any child from the day they're born until they reach the age of puberty. To take some new meaning when you say Baruch Shepatrani now, according to the Takana of Usha, that's also when a parent is released from sustaining their child at that point in time.
Before Usha,
there was no obligation whatsoever, period. That's why Rashi is reading it. Tosafot, on the other hand, says that Ketanim is not coming to Lafuke Gdolim, but Ketanim is coming to Lafuke Ketane Ketanim. That by very young children, Tosafot says there was an obligation. And there is an obligation to sustain the child. He doesn't give you an exact date, it's a loose thing, but he says, very young children, for sure you're obligated to sustain them. Ketanim, they are not obligated, and that's what Usha came to change, which is that the Ketanim, even the Ketanim are. The difference between Rashi and Tosafot is there is a core obligation. According to Rashi, there's no obligation whatsoever to sustain children, and that's what Usha came to fix. According to Tosafot, if a child is so dependent, then there is an obligation to sustain the child when there's that dependency, take Tanim. Usha only came to fix after that point in time, the Tanim, before their Gdolim, but at least Tanim that are at an age, they can maybe sustain themselves, but there's still Tanim, and that's what Usha came to fix, but there was still an underlying obligation for Tanim. So here you have, seemingly, according to Rashi, is a new Takana totally. According to Tosafot, it extends an obligation that already existed, just makes it for a longer duration, meaning that the father is already obligated in. Now, how the obligation works, some say that it's actually a takanat nevi'im, which is, umibzarcha lo titalein. That a person has an obligation of staka that starts primarily with their core family and then extends outwards. There are priorities with regards to staka, just like the priorities work that your own city versus another city in Eretz Yisrael versus outside of Eretz Yisrael. So too, with regards to kiruv, I mean, in terms of relatives, that the core family children take precedence over people that are outside the core family. Family in general takes precedence over non-family. And so too over here, mibasarcha lo titaleim is also a necessity to sustain the children, not mitzad chiyuv, but mitzad staka. And that mitzad staka, that he has to take care of the children. Now again, no obligation, but staka, and that might have implications we're going to see in a second to how we can obligate an individual. When it's staka, can we force them versus when it's an obligation? And that might change the dynamic about what are penalties that we can assume or we can place on the individuals who don't do this. And that depends on how you view the chiyuv over here. This week's Haftorah, it's Shabbat HaGadol. How do you steal from Hashem? The answer is you steal from Hashem when you don't take care of those that are less fortunate. And that you don't cover, you don't clothe those that are close to you, those that are your relatives, you don't take care of them. I mean, that the Haftarah of Shabbat HaGadol, actually, if one looks carefully, is very similar to the Haftarah of Yom HaKippurim. which is that it's Musar about taking care of Ben Adam Le Chaveiro. And within that context, Hashem says, you steal from me when you don't take care of those that are in need, those that need to be clothed, those that need to be fed, those that need to be taken care of. Over here, that's what you're talking about in a sense of tzedakah, Ben Adam Le Chaveiro. The people closest to an individual are their children. And the fact that a person would look away when their children are in need is clearly a problem in their Ben Adam Le Chaveiro. I think that all this has to be looked through the prism of the culture, which is today, number one, that we maintain the immaturity of children for a much longer time, which is that we keep people unable, in a sense, to sustain themselves until they reach the age of 20 because we're trying to educate them, we're trying to allow them time to mature. But that's really an imposed immaturity. In their day, when a child reached the age where they could work, that's what they did. They went out to work. And that was at 7, 8 years old. I mean, by the time you were 12, 13, you were on your own. You were supporting your own family at that point in time. You were getting married. I mean, that there was a different view, especially if you look at it like Tosfot, who says that there is an obligation with regards to Ketanei Ketanim, then once you reach the point where the children are 6, 7, 8 years old, then a parent might feel already, they should be going out to work. Why am I still supporting the child? And therefore, the transition to the independence of the child happened at a much faster pace than we would say today. So what seems to us to be like, oh my goodness, how could they leave the children? In their day was probably a very small window. And was also maybe somebody saying, these guys are lazy. How come they're not out working? How come they're not supporting themselves? And if you look at through that cultural prism, I think it's easier to understand what's going on here in the Gemara rather than thinking about it. How could it be possible that we're letting a 7-year-old, 8-year-old, and we're not sustaining him at all? Alright. Ibaidu. Hilchato kavatei. Oino chato kavatei. Is the aloha like this takana and usha, or is it not like this takana and usha? Tashma. Kiava atu the kamed Rabbi Yehuda. When they came before Rabbi Yehuda, amar lehu. Yarod. Yaldo, babnei mato shadyo, the serpent gave birth, and then he's going to throw the obligation onto the public, onto the public coffers. Here is someone who gave birth to children and was not sustaining his children. He was not providing for them. So they came before Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Yehuda says to them, you know, the serpent, who is, we call it achzari, in general, the nature of the serpent is achzari, still takes care of their young, and this serpent, referring to this individual, gave birth to children, gives birth to his children, and then throws the obligation onto the city, onto the coffers of the tzedakah, that's completely inappropriate. So he's trying to push this individual through coercion of speech to do what he's supposed to do, or to take care of his children. When they came before Chista, kafale asita bitzibora, go turn over a mortar, turn it over, and then stand up on it, Veliko Malema, and let him say, Urva Bayi Bane, the raven wants children, Vau Gavra Lo Bayi Bane, and this individual doesn't want children, meaning that the Orev takes care of its children, and this individual doesn't take care of his children. Rashi brings two possibilities as to whether the Shliach Beitin gets up and makes the announcement, or we force this individual to get up and say it about himself. Seems to me that the Shliach Beitin would be more the likely scenario, because this individual doesn't seem likely to get up there and say such a thing. So the Shliach Beitin gets up there, and the idea is to embarrass him enough into supporting or sustaining his children. The Gemara asks about the Mashal and says, "V'urva bayi bane." Does the raven really want or take care of his children? V'aktiv, don't we read in Tehillim, "Livnei oreva sheikro," that the little children, the little raven babies, are calling out for food because the parents aren't taking care of them. They don't feed them. They look to Hashem for their sustenance to be helped out because the parents abandon them and don't take care of them. So then what's the comparison to the raven over here? The raven doesn't take care of its kids. So why is he comparing this individual? He's saying, oh, the raven does and this person doesn't. So look, Asha. Ha bichivare, ha beukme. Well, that's with the white ravens and that's with the black ravens. Tosafot explains this the simple manner, which is the way that you would read it, is there are two species of ravens. One species of raven does not take care of their children. Another species of raven does take care of their children. And his mashal dealt with the raven that does take care of their children. And on the other side, when the one that the pasuk is talking about is talking about the raven that doesn't take care of their children. Rashi explains it differently. It's interesting that he does. Says it's the same raven. Just depends on the age of the raven. When ravens are very young, they're white. And so therefore the parents reject them because they're not the same color as them. Then as they age, they turn from white to black, and then the parents take care of them at that point in time. So it's a stage in the life of the raven. So the pasuk's talking about the early stage of the raven when they are white. That's when they're not taken care of by their parents. And here we're talking about the later stage of the raven where they are black, and therefore they look like their parents, and then their parents take care of them. So that's the way Rashi explains it, vis-a-vis what Tosafot says.
They don't want
I agree. You're right. You could have argued that having children and sustaining children are two different things. But Chista says that person who really wants children will take care of the children. And it really is a commentary on Pru Ravu. I've said this many times, that the mitzvah Pru Ravu involves two stages, Pru and Ravu. And Rav Hirsch, in explaining the meaning of Pru and Ravu, says Pru is pre, is to multiply. Ravu is from the word riviyah, which means to bring up and to take care of them. And that the mitzvah Pru Ravu is not simply to have children, but to sustain and take care of the children, ensure that they grow up to be quality individuals. And that Pru Ravu involves more than simply having the children. And I think Rav Chista is making that same comment. When he says that he doesn't want to sustain them, that means that he's not interested in the children. If you're having children, then you're interested in sustaining the children. The two are connected. You can't just have children and abandon them. That means you have no interest in the children, because the mitzvah extends beyond just having them. Right, so now, Kiyava to the Kamei Rova. When they came before Rova, Amalei, Nechalach, Demidzane Banech, Mitztaka. Are you comfortable with your children being sustained out of tztaka? V'lo Amran, el v'lo Amid. It's only true if he's not rich. Aval Amid, if he is rich, Kafinin le'al korche, then we force him to give it. Kiha de Rava, like that of Rava, which is Kafir de Rav Natan bar Ami, where he forced Rav Natan bar Ami, Afik Mnei Dalad Mei Azuzah de Tztaka, and he squeezed out of him 400 Zuz for Tztaka. So Kafir, he punished him or pressed him until he gave that Tztaka. So we see here that you're allowed to impose on an individual on Kafinan Lei, we force him to give it Tztaka. So now the conclusion from this, which is the Gemara want to know, is the Alocha like this or is the Alocha not like this? What's pretty clear from what we just saw here is that the halacha is not like this. The lav hilchata ke'usha. Because if the halacha was usha, then there would be takanot in place. The takanah would mean that we could compel individuals to do something. Basically, we could give them malkot and force them to do what the takanah was. The fact that all of the pressure being placed over here is verbal pressure shows you that the takanah is not in place. And that's what Rashi says. Sashma, the late hilchata kavadei, ela meimar amrinalei. We put verbal pressure on the individuals, and maybe they will acquiesce to our pressure. Aval makeup, lo kafinan, but we do not force them. We cannot force them, we cannot give makot in order to engender the outcome that we want, because it's not, halacha is not like this takana, but rather we have to encourage them. Now that is also qualified over here by the case of Amid and Lo Amid, whether he's rich or not. Now rich or not, here there's not given a number or a amount that makes one rich or not rich. It seems that the transition from Amid to Lo Amid is whether the person has the ability to sustain them and support them without going into tztaka himself. He has the ability to pay and support these children and still make a parnasa and keep his house and have his wife and all things that he needs. That would be somebody who's Amid. Someone who's Lo Amid is someone who really can't afford to keep these children. And the question of precedence then, which is, does he give the money to the children so that they are sustained and he gets it from tztaka? Or is the other way around? He keeps for himself and he lets his children go out to tztaka. And that seems to be the question over here when he's Lo Amid. But what you see from Rashi is clearly that kafinan means we force. Force means through malkot. And that means what's written here later on in the Gemara, that we force by tztaka, kfiya, according to Rashi, seems to be malkot. That we give malkot and force a person to give tztaka. And the pressure that we talked about before was simply verbal pressure. Tosafot takes issue with that here in Chulin, in Baba Batra, in a number of places where this comes up, which is that we have a principle, and Tosafot mentions it over here, Heyach kafa oto bishvil tztaka. How could he force him to give tztaka? Vaktim, matan schara b'tzida. We have a principle that any mitzvah that's say in the Torah that has its reward written next to it, we don't force the individual to do the mitzvah, because the fact that the Torah wrote it and gives the reward should be a compelling enough reason for the individual to do it. We don't have to give external pressure in order to compel the individual to do it. Tztaka is one of those items where the man yivarechecha Hashem, that Hashem will bless you if you give tztaka and you take care of those that are less fortunate. So the schar is there. So how could he compel him and force him to give tztaka? Tosfot over here gives numerous reasons. One is, yesh lomar de'akfei bidvarim. The compelling here is not compelling through malkot, but compelling over here is through verbal pressure. Now that makes it a little difficult, because then what were they doing beforehand? I mean, that beforehand it seems like the Gemara says, oh, Rav Chista, Rava, and Rav Yehuda all seem to be talking about cases of verbal pressure. And then it says, well, that's only if he's not rich. But if he's rich, then kafyay, then we force him. Well, Tosa is now saying that force is verbal pressure. Well, then what were they doing before that wasn't verbal pressure? So that's a hard distinction according to Tosafot as to what they were doing prior to this point and what does kafye mean now that was more than it was before. In contrast to Rashi, who clearly views verbal pressure versus malkot being the difference over here. Tosafot on the other hand then gives another defense, which is the possibility that staka is not just a mitzvah to say. There are actually two mitzvot lot asay associated with staka, and therefore we can give malkot here not because of the mitzvah to say side of it, because of the mitzvah lot asay side of it, and therefore we can compel you to do it. Just like any other mitzvah lot asay, a person doesn't keep a mitzvah lot asay, we can compel them to keep it through malkot. So even though by the asay side of it we can't, but from the lot asay side we can compel them, and that's why it's different than other mitzvot asay that we have. Tosafot also then, in Baba Batra, distinguishes between the capabilities of the individual. How much can we compel might have to do or correlate it with how much the person has the ability to give. And therefore, the more that the person has to give or ability to give, then the more pressure we might apply to them. So that means that in a situation where the person is not a lot to give, then we only use verbal pressure. In a case where a person has a lot to give and they're still refusing, maybe they will use physical pressure, meaning we'll use makot in order to compel the individual to give. And when we say that Beit Din does not punish on a mitzvah asay shematan schara b'sida, means that Beit Din is not compelled to do that. But if Beit Din opts to do that, if they so choose because of the circumstances, whether it's the needs of the aniim or the capabilities of the giver, then they have the right to exercise that right and compel the individual to do it. And that might parallel what's happening here between amid and lo amid. When the individual doesn't have the means to do it, then we only exert verbal pressure. Where he clearly has the means to do it, then we're going to exert more than verbal pressure on them because they do have the means to do it. Amar Rabbi Lo, Amar Reish Lakish. So this is another takana of Usha that's being brought by Rabbi Lo, Amar Reish Lakish. Pelusha itkinu akotev kol nechasav libanav hu v'ishto nizoni mem. A person who grants in his lifetime all of his possessions to his son, they are allowed to be sustained out of that trust. So he basically creates a trust, puts all of his possessions into this trust for the benefit of his son. So now he has nothing left. There's nothing left to him or his wife. The takanat chachamim here is, it's not minadin, because minadin he gave away all his property, he has no rights to it anymore. But the takanat chachamim over here is that the child must sustain the father and the mother, the father and the wife, in this instance, out of the property that was given to him. So matkiv lo Rabbi Zeira, bitema Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani, gdolo mizu amro. They said something more than this. Why do you need a takanah to tell us this? It should be so obvious. Because amanato nizonet minichasav whom ishto mibaye. After the death of the husband, after the death of the father, when the possessions pass mido oraita to the children, there's a takanat chachamim that the almana, the widow, is allowed to be sustained out of the estate. So in the face of a din doraita, where it's yerusha doraita and it clearly belongs to the children, and the chachamim stepped in a sense, disowned them or disenfranchised them from their possessions by allowing the almanah to be nizonet from it. Then in the case where we're talking about him and his wife during his lifetime, where he gave a gift, he certainly should be entitled to take from that or get from that. The shalach ravin b'igarte, because we have a letter from ravin that says, mishimet v'niach almanah ubat, someone who passes away and leaves only two people, a widow and a daughter. So the daughter is the inheritor of the estate at this point in time, and the almanah, the widow, is left over. Almanato nizonet minichasav. The almanah is sustained out of the estate. Niseit abat. After the bat gets married, the property now shifts from the daughter to her husband. She's bringing this into her marriage. Nevertheless, almanato nizonet minichasav. The almanah still is sustained out of that. Meita habat. The daughter dies at this point in time. The son-in-law has now inherited all that property. This woman has no blood connection anymore to this property because her daughter already passed away. Her daughter got married, passed away. All the property now belongs to the son-in-law. Nevertheless, almanato nizonet nechasav. The almanah still has a right to get paid out of that or to be sustained out of the estate that once was now belongs to the son-in-law. So you see here that the chachamim are mitakein in all these cases where it's far-fetched, meaning that there's almost no connection to the property anymore. The almanah still gets rights. So now you have to tell me in a case where a father gifts all of his property to his son in his lifetime, that you would have to sustain the father and his wife out of that property? Seems obvious. I'm Rabbi Yehuda ben Achutosh, Rabbi Yossi bar Chanina. So Rabbi Yehuda, the nephew of Rabbi Yossi bar Chanina, says, Ayadi haya maseh. There was an incident that came to me. V'amru, amanato nizonet minichasav. So he says that the case that an amanato is sustained out of the estate, who you told me by it, then by the case of him and his wife, then you have to say this? My says, no, ma'udu tema. I would have thought, hatam hu deleka tatarach. Over there, there's nobody to make a living for this woman. In general, an amanah, at that point in time, a widow was left on her own. She had no ability to sustain or support herself. Then, unless she got married again, or was sustained out of the estate, this woman would be left penniless and would have nothing. So in that case, where she has no ability to sustain herself, the Chachamim stepped in and made a takana that she will be supported out of the estate. Of a hocha, here, the father is still an able-bodied individual. He can go to work. So after he gifts everything to his son, we're going to say to him, Nitrach li didei lo dida. We're going to say, go back to work and earn money for yourself and for your wife. Don't take it out of the gift that you granted to your son. Kamash malon, we say that that is not the case, and they are entitled to sustaining or sustenance out of the gift that was granted to his son. Now, Rashi notes over here, and it's important, Tosafot also discusses the issue, which is that in general, Heicha deleka lameichosh netikun olam. Over here, there's no problem with tikun olam. Could go into high lokeach shlo tzimaot shavu a rabbanon ki yoresh. In a case where a purchaser did not expend any money, then the chachamim made him like a yoresh, like an inheritor. So if you have parties that have liens on the property, and then the property is given over to the yoresh, those people that have liens have a right then to go to collect from that property, because the yoresh didn't do anything. He just, the property came to him. When it comes to him, it comes with all the liens that were on it from his time of his father. On the other hand, when you have a lokeach, when you have a purchaser of property, if we will allow after the fact in people who had obligations, creditors to come and collect from somebody who purchased property, then nobody would ever purchase property, because they'd be at risk that after the fact the guy would borrow money and those creditors would come back and take it from him. So what we say is once a lokeach takes the property, that property is now out of the ability for one to come back and make any claims against it. From that point forward, there will be no claims made. Now, if they were prior to the purchasing of the property, okay, then there's a claim because it preceded his buying the property. Although there will still say that they have to collect from property that is not encumbered, or property that was sold later, before they come and collect from this property that is encumbered or subject to the liens that came before his purchase. But anything that was prospective from the time of the purchase and onward, they have no rights to. Over here, that's exactly what we have. Matana kemecher. When you give a gift, it's the equivalent of selling it. So here, they grant the gift to the son, there should be no claim or residual claim of the father on the property. When we come along and say, okay, go ahead and now feed the father and the mother out of this estate, we're going basically and retracting the equivalent of a gift that's been given, which is the equivalent of a lokeach, that we normally wouldn't do. But over here, since he expended no money, he didn't pay for it, he got it as a gift for free, plus it's only because the father is giving it to his son, and therefore there's no question that his intention to give it to him is in a manner where we think that he will get paid out of it or he'll get sustained out of it. In that case, the Chachamim were willing to step in and protect the father and protect the mother so they get sustained out of it. Normally, if it was a lokeach, we wouldn't say that. If it was given to a, someone came and bought the property and bought everything that he owned, and then he had nothing to eat, we wouldn't say that the purchaser has to support the father or the mother in that case. But that's different, and that's what Rashi says over here. There's no issue of tikkun olam. There's no question then, people won't make purchases because this is a gift. That's number one. So we treat him like a yoresh, an inheritor, rather than normal case of matana. Then Rashi says later on, va'afgav de matana kemecher le'inyan shibud. Even though in general a gift has the same status as a mecher, hatam hiudula avid le lo nechel le'nafshe lo yahayiv le matana. That is because in general, when someone gives a gift, people give gifts for a reason. When they give a gift for a reason, it means that somebody did something good for them. And this is the quid pro quo, meaning that what they're giving back as a gift is in a sense in lieu of payment for the nice thing that they did to them. Therefore, when they grant the gift, they want to protect the recipient of the gift. And that means when they give the gift with achrayut, which means that they guarantee that if the gift is taken away or creditors come and claim it, that they'll have recourse against this individual to get the gift back. Why don't we say the same thing over here? We could say the same thing. When the parents come and try to get sustained out of the estate, that means now we're diminishing the gift that was given to this party. And he should have recourse then back to the father to take more or to fulfill whatever he took, whatever the father's taking out of that. Rashi says it's not true here, because the reason the father is giving it to the son is simply because he's his son, not because he did him any good. By the son, we're not going to say that. So Rashi says here that this gift of the son is different in two ways. It's different in number one, there was no money given, and therefore there's no reason to protect the property and say, oh, well, if we allow creditors now to make claims on here, then nobody will buy property. That's just not the case. He didn't expend any money. So the fact that we're now making a takanah to allow the father and mother to take out of the estate is not going to change the dynamics in the marketplace, because here he didn't pay any money for it. Number two is, even though gifts in general are protected from claims like this and from liens on them, that's only true when the gift is given and says in lieu of payment for kindness or goodness that was done to the individual. There we say there's automatic achrayut assumed in that case. But here, he's granting it to his child. The reason he's granting it to him is because he's his child, not because necessarily he did anything for him, or is in lieu of payment to him, or a quid pro quo. Therefore, there is no achrayut. And that's why in this case, we're able to establish the takana, or basically we're making it obvious that the parents should have a right to get from the estate over here. There's no reason we should believe that the gift precludes them from gaining anything out of here or taking out of here. If an almanah gets it, this case is no different than an almanah. This case is no different than a yoresh. Because even though it's a matana, even though it looks like mecher, in this case it looks much more like yerusha than it does like a mecher, because it's given to a child who would otherwise be a yoresh, and it's done without any payment given for it. And because of that, it would be obvious if the almanah gets out of the yerusha, then certainly the parents here should get out of the gift that was given to the child. Ibailu. Hilchata kavate, olete hilchata kavate. Once again, we ask the same question. Is the halacha like this takana v'usha or not like the takana v'usha? Tashma, the Rabbi Chanina, the Rabbi Yonatan, Havukaime, they were sitting together, talking, standing together. Adu gavra, gochin, an individual came, bent over, v'nashke, the Rabbi Yonatan, akarei. So you have Rabbi Chanina and Rabbi Yonatan standing together. All of a sudden, this individual appears there, bows down to Rabbi Yonatan and kisses him on his leg or his feet. I'm like, Rabbi Chanina, my high. What's this guy doing? Why is this guy so enchanted with you? What is he doing? He's kissing your feet? This was an individual who wrote all of his possession, gifted all of his possessions in his lifetime to his children. And I forced them to sustain him. So now the Gemara says, Iyamart bishlama labdina. If you say that this is not an obligation mitzadadin, Mishumachi, I see in you. That's why he forced him. Eliya Mardina, if it's really Minitzaradin, as inu, boy, he would have to force them. So now the way Rashi says it over here is that Vasitinu, the reason that he forced him and he pressed him over here is that he acted with him Lifni Mishurta Din. He acted him, this was not the din, and he did it Lifni Mishurta Din, and this is why that guy was so grateful to him, because he went Lifni Mishurta Din. But Idina Hava, if this was the Ikar Din, then he wouldn't have to be thankful to Rabbi Yonatan, because all Rabbi Yonatan was paskin halacha. If the halacha is this way, and that he paskin halacha in that way, then there's nothing to say thank you for. He was entitled to it. Entitlement min a din, he doesn't have to say thank you Rabbi Yonatan for paskin halacha. The only reason he had to say thank you to Rabbi Yonatan is because he was going with Nimishur to din. That's the way Rashi reads it. It does not read so simply into the wording, because the Gemara seems to be focused on force. And that's what Rav Tosafot says. Tosfot says, wait, asintinu means he forced him. Tosfot here is consistent with the shita before. He says, hay asui, tzarech lamar, dahinu bidvarim. That's with words. He compelled him through words. He compelled him verbally to sustain his father. Because if it was meikar adin, then would you have to compel him verbally? You could give him malkot. If the ikar takana was that way, he wouldn't have to revert to using verbal pressure. He could use physical pressure. He could give him malkot. The fact that he used verbal pressure is indicative of the fact that he wasn't doing this mitzad adin, but rather lifnim mishurat adin. Right, so Tosfot brings other examples of asui being a verbal pressure, although it's very difficult, because we know there's another example of this in the Gemara, which is get me'useh. A get me'useh is a get that was done by force. Over there, it's clearly force, not verbal pressure. There, it's clearly get me'useh means that they compel them by physical pressure, although there are examples there of being compelling him by forcing him out of the city, by doing things to him that make him want to do it because otherwise he's going to lose everything. But get me who said the meaning there really has a meaning of physical force, not just verbal pressure. But here Tosafot claims that the asintinu is verbal pressure. The reason what probably compelled Tosafot to say that is that the way Rashi's reading it is, oh, he had to force him because it was only a Lifnim Mishurat Adin. Had it been Minadin, he wouldn't have to force him. What do you mean he wouldn't have to force him? If it's Mishurat HaDin, of course you're going to force him. Of course you can compel him. Rashi avoids that by saying it has to do with the response of the individual towards Rabbi Yonatan. Had it been Minadin, he wouldn't have to thank him. He wouldn't have to do anything. Things that it was the Fnidr Shuradin, that's why he thanked him. But that almost separates it from Lashon HaGemara, which is talking about force and not force. So Tosfos wants to read it inside the Lashon HaGemara that the issue here is force and not force. So what he has to say is there's a difference between the compelling that's done by Lifnei Mishurat HaDin, which is verbal pressure, versus if it was Minadin, which would be compelling through Malkot. Then you could give him, that's the way Rashi read it, right? I'm sorry, similar to the way Rashi read Kfiyah before, which is that Kfiyah means Malkot versus the case of verbal pressure. If it's Minadin, you can use Malkot. If it is not Minadin, then you can only use verbal pressure. So that's what's reading that similar type of structure into this piece of the Gemara as well, but what you see from here is Let Hilchot Kavate. Here we have two Takanot and Usha. In both cases, we see the practice of the Chachamim is not like the Takana of Usha, not Minadin, but rather Lifnei Mishurat HaDin, and therefore they're only using verbal pressure over here. Okay, we're going to stop here, three lines down on the top of Nun Amud Aleph.